From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For years, while many Germans dreamed of reunification, Günter Grass argued against it. Grass is the author of The Tin Drum and one of Germany's most prominent novelists and essayists. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Günter Grass about the rise in right-wing violence since reunification and about the years in which he was a member of the Hitler Youth. Also today, round up the usual suspects. We talk with Algene Harmetz about her new book on the making of Casablanca in Hollywood during World War II. World music critic Milo Miles reviews a new collection of vintage African rumbas. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album of Christmas music by Mel Torme. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Somalia, American and French forces arrived in the devastated town of Baidoa today and immediately escorted their first convoy of relief supplies to the town. From Baidoa, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
A convoy of 10 military vehicles set out from the airport, bringing a small quantity of high-protein food to the local orphanage. Crowds of eager onlookers blocked its way in the streets. Relief efforts in Baidoa have been stymied in recent weeks by armed gunmen who robbed relief workers and looted supplies. Yesterday, gunmen broke into the UNICEF compound demanding fuel. By the time U.S. and French troops arrived this morning, however, the streets were calm and the gunmen and their technical vehicles had disappeared. Military officials say that today's mini-convoy of food was a symbolic demonstration of U.S. resolve to protect the relief effort. They hope to escort their first large-scale food convoys into the famine-stricken interior of the country by the end of the week. I'm Deborah Wong in Baidoa.
Attorney General William Barr said today that he's accepted a federal investigator's recommendation and will conduct a criminal probe of possible wrongdoing at the House Bank. Investigator Malcolm Wilkie's report to the Attorney General said that a small number of past and current lawmakers may have broken the law in their dealings with the bank. Wilkie didn't give a number of the lawmakers who might face further investigation, nor did he name any names. The report said that he's reviewed 329 House bank accounts and sent letters to most members clearing them of wrongdoing. President-elect Clinton spent the day in private meetings. He's expected to announce more cabinet appointments tomorrow and hopes to make the remaining choices by Christmas. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
With his day-and-a-half-long teach-in on the economy behind him, the president-elect is returning his attention to the job of filling his cabinet. He has reportedly chosen the director of the Arkansas Health Department, Joycelyn Elders, as Surgeon General, and is possibly ready to announce his pick to head the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Former San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros is considered the top candidate for the HUD spot. Energy and Interior are two other cabinet positions Clinton may fill this week. Retiring Colorado Senator Tim Worth and former Arizona Governor Bruce Babbitt are leading candidates for those posts. Clinton may wait until next week to announce his choices for the national security positions, State, Defense, CIA, and National Security Council. House Armed Services Committee Chairman Les Aspin has been mentioned as a possible defense secretary. Clinton's transition director, Warren Christopher, a former Carter administration official, is considered likely to get the State Department job. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 29 points to close at 3,255. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Red Cross officials are demanding access to more than 500 Bosnian prisoners who are missing from a Serbian-run detention camp in western Bosnia. The prisoners were a mixed group of Croatians and Bosnian Muslims. A Red Cross spokesman said that local Serbian authorities loaded the prisoners on buses on Sunday and took them away without notifying the Red Cross. Two groups of more than 1,000 Bosnian prisoners have been released by the Serbs this week. Doctors in Italy's public health service have been on strike against the government's package of cuts on health care spending. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
Only emergency services were guaranteed today as more than 120,000 doctors in the National Health Service stopped work. More than 20,000 of them took to the streets of Rome, voicing their opposition at the government's new user-pay health policies and calling for the health minister to step down. The measures include the introduction of an income ceiling over which people must pay for visits to the family doctor, the closure of mobile health units, and the privatization of much of the health sector. The doctors say not only are their jobs at risk, but the measures will divide the country between those who can afford to be ill and those who can't. It's the first time that all doctors have gone on strike together, and more labour action is planned. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Reporters in Little Rock got a preview of President-elect Clinton's thinking on health care reform today. Clinton spokesman George Stephanopoulos said that the plan would give cutting costs priority over protecting those without health insurance. In his briefing today, Stephanopoulos said that steady increases in health insurance costs and out-of-pocket medical expenses are killing American families. At the same time, Stephanopoulos said the incoming administration wants to be mindful of the 37 million people who are uninsured. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Günter Grass, is one of Germany's best-known writers. Much of his writing, including his best-known novel, The Tin Drum, has dealt with the legacy of the Nazis. Grass is watching with alarm as a growing neo-Nazi movement attacks foreigners in Germany today. But he's not surprised. Since the mid-60s, in articles and speeches, he has spoken out against reunification. Some of those articles were collected in his recent book, Two States, One Nation. He wrote that a unified German state existed in varying sizes for no more than 75 years, and that state laid the foundation for Auschwitz. That place of terror is a permanent wound that makes a future unified German state doomed to fail. Part of what gives Grass an understanding of the Nazi movement today is that Grass himself was a member of a Hitler youth group in the 1940s. I asked him what he thinks is behind the rise of the neo-Nazi movement.
In East Germany, it was forbidden to speak out anything like this, and everything what was inside was hidden, the pot was closed, but not now the pot is open, and we can see what really was behind. But now this right-wing extreme people from East and West, that's one of the only results of unification we have, that they really come together. And the other reason, I think it's very important that some politicians in Germany belonging to the ruling party are speaking in the same way than the skinheads do. Sure, they have ties and they are well dressed and they know to use words, but it is the same aim. They want what they really want, to kick out the foreign people. And so they work together in a terrible way. And if it's not possible to stop this kind of policy coming from Bonn, from the government, it will be very difficult to stop the right-wing movement.
You don't support the tightening of controls of immigrants seeking political asylum?
No, I think this is a great fault. If this is coming from the extreme right-wing, there was no reason to follow this line. And if they are doing this as they want, it will be a triumph of the right wing. And they will go on with their terror. Not only the government, also the police is blind on the right eye. They are very, very successful and very immediately to the point if there is a protest action of the left wing. Their reaction is quite immediately. But if the things are coming from the right, they are lazy, they don't see it, they are looking for excuses and so on.
The government has banned two neo-Nazi groups, and it asked the Supreme Court to restrict freedom of speech for two of the leaders to prevent them from instigating violence. Do you support that?
No, that's we have laws enough, and what was possible before to stop this movement in the beginning, and they didn't. They only see if there's a protest coming from the left side, then the reaction is quite quick. But from the right side, it's now, for this case, it's too late.
So tell me more about why you don't support banning the neo-Nazi groups.
Because this young people, this is only the end of something. Was years ago. There are social reasons behind, and we have to speak with these people. We have to discuss with them. Also, if they don't want to discuss, just to ban, that's the same policy you had in the communistic country, where it was forbidden. to speak out. And there was no help. Now this government break down, and we see what's the result. I don't think that it's very, very helpful to make it by ban policy like they're trying to do now.
My guest is Günter Grass, and he has a new novel called The Call of the Toad. I want to ask you a little bit about your childhood. I know that you were a member of the Hitler Youth,
yes.
And you joined a Hitler organization at age 10. Did your parents want you to join the Hitler group?
They never spoke about it, but it was normal that everybody has to go. And I liked to go, too. It was marvelous for a 10-year-old boy to go with his groups, with a tent and with a flag playing Boy Scouts like this. It wasn't political at all in the beginning. It became more and more political. Was a really successful propaganda done by the Nazis, and they really were successful to organize the youth movement. And for me, the breakdown was when I was 16, 17. I became soldier with 16, the last year of the war. And with 17, the war was over, and I was in American prison camp, prisoner of war. And slowly, I discovered what really has happened. And in the beginning, I didn't believe. I thought this is propaganda, what they are telling us. It's not possible. The German people has done this. And then, some weeks later, started this in Nuremberg, this war criminal process, and I listened to the radio, and I heard my former youth leader, Baldo von Schirach, and he said, yes, that's true, that's terrible. We have done this things, this kind of crimes, and he tried to apologize the youth movement. He said they didn't know anything, what was true. But from this moment on, it was clear for me what has happened. And this knowledge never left me.
Did you ever challenge what you were taught? And what would have happened to you if you expressed your questions?
But there was no many questions. We were very sure that we are on the right side. And everybody was against us, and we are surrounded by enemies, and we have to be strong. And I did believe this up to the age of 17.
Your parents were pro-Nazi?
My parents were my father membered the party in 1936. He was one of this middle class opportunists who did go with a mess.
Now, I've read about you that after the war you were wounded at the end of the war and captured.
Yeah.
And then when the war was over, as part of this like denazification program, you were forced to see the newly liberated death camp of Dachau.
Yes.
Can you explain how that happened? I wasn't aware of that there was a program in
which... Yes, there was this kind of re-education program.
Mm-hmm.
Very naive then. And as I told you in the beginning, I always said that's propaganda. And only when we heard on the radio our former Hitler Youth leader speaking out what has happened, and all this propaganda lies were washed away, and I started to see clear.
What was it like when you saw Dachau?
I didn't believe. I saw the camp, it was awful, but I didn't believe what really has happened there in the beginning.
So even seeing it, you didn't believe
it? Yeah.
So when you actually heard your youth leader testify at the Nuremberg trials and you realized, wow, this was really true, did you immediately change? Did you immediately stop believing the propaganda you were taught? Or was that a much slower process?
Yes, was it immediately a shock? But it took me more than 2 or 3 years really to come to the point. And I was reading books about it, and I informed myself. And I had the chance in the western part of Germany to look out for my own way, to find my own political point of view. If I see to people of my generation who did grow up in East Germany, it was much more difficult for them because they changed in changing the shirt, the brown shirt of the Nazi youth movement against the blue shirt of the communistic youth movement. There was no time between and no chance for them to make their own decision. This is one of the different things we had in East and West Germany. And then after the war, when after this prison camp, I was always interested to be an artist, as a sculptor. My first professional training was as a stonemason, and afterwards I entered the art school in Düsseldorf and then in Berlin. But in all this time, I also started to write poems, playwrights, and read a lot of books, mixed and wild, was without any program. I had the feeling I have to do very quick, because in the Nazi time we didn't get this kind of literature. It was in the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s when I first read novels of Hemingway and Faulkner and Kafka and all this forbidden literature. It was very important for me when I was young.
I guess that's another experience that a lot of people in East Germany wouldn't have had.
No, Kafka was forbidden afterwards too in East Germany.
My guest is writer Günter Grass. He has a new novel called The Call of the Toad. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. German writer Günter Grass is my guest. Why do you think that the neo-Nazi movement today is made up of young people? These aren't the people who lived through the war. These are the people who were born after the war.
The reasons are mixed up. There's this one, I told you that the social situation in East Germany is terrible. And this young people in East Germany before were organized in the communistic youth movements. And now the houses they had, the youth houses, are closed. They are on the street. They are unemployed. They are the first victims of this other participation we have now in Germany. We don't have any more a wall, but Germany is divided a second time in Germans of first class belonging to the West and Germans of the second class belonging to the East. And this situation, this terrible result of a too quick reunification is creating hate. The first rate of hate is between Germans, East and West Germans.
Do you think the East Germans resent the West Germans?
Both. From West, they are, if they go to East, they're speaking like nice colonial officers to them. Please do like this. If you will be successful, as we are in capitalism, you have to forget about this, and you do this. They're always teaching them. And then they see the results. The result is unemployment and a terrible economic situation, and it is starting with mistrusting each other, and then hate is growing, and this hate between the Germans is in the next step to other people, to foreigners who are in a more bad situation than the second class Germans in East Germany. It's going down and down.
Where do you live now?
I live in Berlin. And outside, on the country, in Schleswig-Holstein, the north of Germany.
What are some of the ways you've seen Berlin change since reunification?
Now, we live first time after many years without a wall, but East and West Berlin still exists. The people don't mix up. I think we have We have the wall still in the head. And this is what I said in the beginning of our discussion or conversation, that the quick reunification did give us, don't give us the chance to do it in a slow way, to come nearer together. Now the economic situation, and the bad economic situation in East Germany, is overwhelming everything.
Have you been watching a lot of refugees from Bosnia and Herzegovina settling in Germany?
Yes. In my Berlin house, where one of my sons is living, we have every weekend a family from Bosnia coming. My son is getting them, picking them up, the grandmother and the mother and one child, and then they come to our house and we try to speak together. It's very difficult. And the young mother with the boy is still missing the husband. There are coming no news from there, and we are really confronted with these problems, what is happening there. And I think it's a shame. It's shameful for Europe and for the Western world that we were not able to see these problems coming before. That, now that's now 12 years after the death of Tito, and it was clear that after the death of this extraordinary man who was able to keep all this together, the things will change there. But nobody was prepared, and still nothing is happening. Perhaps there's no oil, that there was no reaction from the Western side. This may be one reason, but in any case, it's a shame for Western Europe and also a shame for the United States that nothing really happens there.
Does the war in the former Yugoslavia seem very close to you?
Yes, it's happening in Europe, and it's bringing us back to difficult and dangerous things in European history. Looking back to the beginning of the First World War, who started in Sarajevo. And I see clearly the danger that this war is in the beginning. It can jump in the next weeks and months to the Kosovo, that means Albania. It can jump to Macedonia, because there the Serbian side and the Greek side and the Bulgarians and the Turkish are interested. And there are so many reasons that this localized war in Yugoslavia can be the beginning of a Third World War.
You think that's possible?
It is possible, because the Western world, who seemed to be or believed to be the winner of the Cold War, now is without an enemy and are really confused. They are stupid like winners are. Accept this fact that the communistic world is now away. There's no solution. There's no plan of help. After the Second World War, the United States were strong enough and to create this Marshall Plan. It was a great help for Europe. This time, nothing is happening.
One last question: since you are a prominent writer in Germany, and since you've always been associated with liberal politics, have you become anything of a target to the right?
Yes, sure. It was in 1965 they burned the door of my house in Berlin, and I got a lot of dirty letters, and also in these days, and also in the last 2 years, in the last year, two times. We are living outside the village on the forest, and two times cars stopped amid the nights and crying right-wing paroles, but my wife and me, we are not very much afraid.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Günter Grass's new novel is The Call of the Toad. World music critic Milo Miles has no use for nostalgia in popular music. He says old songs have to sound alive in the present. And he reports happily that new collections of vintage Roombas from Zaire carry their years with grace and joy. Thank you.
mio tesoro. Vieni, vieni da me.
A few years ago, I defined world music as any non-English popular music clearly affected by international mass media, as well as rhythm and blues and rock and roll. We may have to expand that to include any popular urban music invented after World War II. One of the chief prompters for this change is the marvelous original rumba bands from Zaire. They do not play no rock and roll, but there is nothing folkloric about them either. The French label African has one of the most balanced and extensive surveys of early rumbas in its Mervier du Passé series. Two particularly fine sets are dedicated to Joseph Kabasele, known as Grand Kale. As the canny leader of the band African Jazz, he switched from polkas to rumbas in 1953 and invented a new indigenous style of swing. The glory years for Kale's African Jazz Band lasted until the early 60s. In that period, the lineup featured celebrated performers like saxophonist Manu Dibango, singer Taboulé Rochereau, and influential guitarist Dr. Nico, whose hard, peeling notes offer an irresistible call to dance. Another recommended sequence of Congo Zaire CDs highlights bands that might be called the sons of Grand Kale. Late 60s groups like Orchestra Veve that pulled the Latin beat into more sinuous, hypnotic grooves. This was wild stuff for its day in Zaire. Yet strangely enough, the brashness and daring of trend-setting pop fades more with time than the sweetness and precision of top-flight performances. The finest old music sounds charming not because it is antique, but because true ardor is ageless.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge. The rumbas he reviewed are in the Mervé du Passé series from Stern's African label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Kilima wate loko na moleli pasi yango batimiso oh. Yope mopaya toko wela nini chose nanga ya bakoko oh. Liwa nanga bakoko baboyi hey, hey. Nako kufa soki tata sinye oh, oh. Kunya ya nini yone mopaya woko Opi kakao tumoli mozindo woko Sikse nanga mama atike langa yo.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. is one of the most famous lines in a movie full of famous lines. But Casablanca almost didn't end with that final famous scene. Coming up, we talk with Algene Harmetz, author of a new book about the making of Casablanca called Round Up the Usual Suspects. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album of new and old Christmas songs sung by Mel Torme. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. military officials in Somalia say that the first phase of a plan to get aid to the ravaged town of Baidoa is now complete. A joint American and French force moved into the city at dawn, watched by a peaceful crowd. Colin Blaine was traveling with the convoy, and he filed this report for the BBC.
United States commandos had been pressed to go to Baidoa almost from the day they landed in Mogadishu a week ago. Aid workers appealed for protection against routine violence and bandit attacks. When the Marines did go in, they encountered no resistance, only smiling faces and happy crowds lining their route. For the 30 or so international relief workers who've been robbed and shot at, it wasn't a minute too soon. These have been days of mayhem. The last six road convoys have been looted. The Marines will bring an end to all that, for the time being at least. The gunmen appear to have melted away. The hardest problem to solve is how to stop them coming back.
Colin Blaine reporting from Baidoa in Somalia. Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger says that the U.S. will push for a more aggressive stance in efforts to stop the fighting in Bosnia. Speaking today in Geneva, the secretary pointed to enforcement of a U.N. Security Council no-fly zone in the area and a new look at an arms embargo that critics say keeps Bosnian government forces from moving against Serbian factions. Eagleburger charged that Serbian factions have broken promises to allow aid shipments and to close detention camps. And he said the situation in the former Yugoslavia has become increasingly desperate. Republican congressional leaders are asking CNN, C-SPAN, and National Public Radio for equal broadcast time after all three networks broadcast large portions of President-elect Bill Clinton's economic conference. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
In letters to the three networks, Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole and House Minority Leader Bob Michael argued that, quote, no political party has a monopoly on proposals to confront our nation's challenges. They were referring to the 2 days of economic discussion Clinton held in Little Rock on Monday and Tuesday, most or all of which was broadcast live on the three networks. Dole and Michael called this, quote, a staggering commitment of broadcasting time that rivals almost nothing in recent memory, especially given the fact that the event was paid for by the Democratic National Committee, unquote. And they asked that in the interest of journalistic balance, future Republican Party events be given the same attention. A CNN spokesman responded by citing wide national interest in the new president's forum, saying, quote, we cover this as a news event, not a Democratic event. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 29 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A government probe of the House banking controversy has found possible criminal conduct by a small number of lawmakers and calls for a Justice Department investigation. Malcolm Wilkie says that all of those tied to the scandal are former members of the House, not present members. U.S. Attorney General William Barr says that he has created a special unit to handle the bank problem, and it will be staffed by those who have been aiding Wilkie. According to various government officials in Egypt, extremist attacks on foreign visitors this year have had a definite impact on tourism. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak says tourism has dropped by about a third due to Islamic militant attacks on foreigners. That's the highest official estimate of damage to the tourist industry, Egypt's main source of foreign income. More than 70 people have died in extremist-related violence in Egypt this year. This summer, militants began targeting tourists, and a British woman was killed in an extremist attack in October. In a news conference today, Mubarak said militant attacks were being exaggerated by the foreign media. He maintains extremist groups have been crushed in the massive nationwide crackdown the government launched last week. Authorities say the crackdown has netted more than 650 extremist arrests in Cairo alone and that 90% of the country's militants are now in custody. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
The government says that new housing starts moved up 0.5% last month, mainly in the south and west. New construction was down in both the northeast and midwestern parts of the nation. The Commerce Department says that housing starts last month were at their highest point in 8 months. This year overall, housing starts have gone up in 7 months and dropped in 4 months. And analysts expect a slow improvement to continue. In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The great film Casablanca turned 50 years old in 1992. The anniversary was appropriately celebrated with the release of a new print that played in theaters and is available on video. My guest, Algin Harmetz, has written a new book on the making of Casablanca called Round Up the Usual Suspects. For many years, Harmetz covered the movie industry for the New York Times. She says no other movie better demonstrates America's mythological vision of itself, tough on the outside and moral within, capable of sacrifice and romance without sacrificing individualism. Humphrey Bogart, as Rick, never sticks his neck out for anyone until the end of the film. In that final scene, he convinces the love of his life, played by Ingrid Bergman, to leave him and fly to safety with her husband, a leader of the resistance.
Because you're getting on that plane.
I don't understand. What about you?
I'm staying here with him till the plane gets safely away.
No, Richard, no. What has happened to you? Last night
Last night we said a great many things. You said I was to do the thinking for both of us. Well, I've done a lot of it since then. It all adds up to one thing. You're getting on that plane with Victor where you belong.
But Richard, no,
Now, you've got to listen to me. You have any idea what you'd have to look forward to if you stayed here? 9 chances out of 10, we'd both wind up at a concentration camp. Isn't that true, Louis?
I'm afraid Major Strasser would insist.
You're saying this only to make me go.
I'm saying it because it's true. Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Yeah. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. But I've got a job to do, too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. Now, now. He's looking at you, kid.
Algin Harmetz, welcome to Fresh Air. That's such a beautiful scene, and it's a very, very moving scene. It's also a scene that solved a serious problem for the screenwriters of Casablanca. What was the problem they were stuck with in the ending here?
Well, you know that one of the chief myths about Casablanca is that nobody knew what the ending was going to be until they shot it. If you think about that, that's absolutely absurd. How can you make a picture not knowing what the ending is going to be? Would Ilse go off with Paul Henreid? Would she stay behind with Humphrey Bogart? They did know that, and it was the first year of the war. There was no way that she could stay behind with her lover. She had to go off with the man who was going back to the fight. What they had a problem doing was making her decision to go off with Paul Henreid credible. And that was why the screenwriters kept writing new speeches every single day during the early part of July. That scene was shot on July 17th and July 18th, and actually Bogart got so angry at all of the new speeches. The Hill of Beans speech was written the night before, the We'll Always Have Paris speech was written the night before, that he spent much of that day sulking in his dressing room.
What were some of the alternate speeches that were written for that last scene that we never got to hear in the movie?
One of the things that happened as those speeches were being written during the second week of July, 1942, by Howard Koch, one of the three major screenwriters, was that they got both more romantic, we'll always have Paris, and more patriotic. It doesn't matter a hill of beans what happens to three little people. All of that was added the closer that they got to shooting that scene. But in every version of the script and in the play on which Casablanca was based, the woman goes off with her husband. In no case does she stay behind.
Now, one ending for Casablanca called for Humphrey Bogart to be arrested, but everybody felt like, well, no, Humphrey Bogart cannot be arrested at the end of the film. Why not, and how did they rewrite the ending?
The ending in which he got arrested was in the play. That was the way, in the play, he held a gun on Major Strasser until the airplane got safely off, tossed the gun on the table, and the last line to Renault was, "It doesn't matter, Louis, you still owe me 5,000 francs." The last line in almost every version of the scripts, and there were many of them, was still the same. But it was quite obvious that we were now at war with Germany, and there was no way that the dirty Nazi could be allowed to win. Hollywood wouldn't allow that, and certainly the American public wouldn't allow it. So the ending was changed. At some one point, it was thought that maybe both Rick and Strasser, one idea, maybe both Rick and Strasser would be shot. In another version, Renault and Rick are actually playing chess, and it's obvious that Rick will be in trouble when the movie is over and probably will go to jail. But they're playing chess, and both kings are chess-mated, and the game is over just as the airplane soars overhead, and that's the end of the movie.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Algene Harmetz, and she's written a new book on the making of Casablanca called Round Up the Usual Suspects. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Algene Harmetz, who's written about the movie industry for many years and is the author of a new book on the making of Casablanca called Round Up the Usual Suspects. Casablanca was made during the Second World War, and during the war there was a set of Hollywood regulations, I guess you could call it, about how to measure a movie's effect on American morale during wartime. What was the manual that was sent around?
The Office of War Information opened a Bureau of Motion Pictures in Hollywood at Hollywood and Vine, which I find just terribly amusing because that was the defining intersection during that era of Hollywood. That was what all the radio comedians used to define Hollywood as. And the manual started out with seven questions, and the first question was, will this picture help win the war? And the studios got very good at pretending that their movies had redeeming social value and would help win the war. But in actuality, the studio moguls were very patriotic, and they were very eager to make pictures that would increase American morale and to make pictures that would help win the war. And in a funny sense, they went too much the opposite way, and you ended up with a lot of pictures, dozens, I'd say hundreds of pictures that were so layered with propaganda that the movies just lay there. You had these big undigested speeches about why we were fighting the war and what it all meant. And Casablanca was extremely lucky to be made during the first summer of the war, before the Bureau of Motion Pictures opened, and before there was a great deal of pressure on Hollywood to force-feed the movies with patriotism. So though Casablanca is propaganda, every movie is propaganda for something or other, although it was propaganda, it was propaganda out of the story, out of the performances, and not out of a lot of speeches layered in.
So do you think if Casablanca had been made later in the war, it would have to have been written differently?
Absolutely. Just go compare. I suggest that you take Casablanca and rent it at your nearby video store, and at the same time rent Passage to Marseille, which is Warner Brothers' attempt to remake Casablanca a couple of years later. Had almost the entire same cast, had the same director, Michael Curtiz, same producer, Hal Wallace, Humphrey Bogart, Claude Rains, Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, Helmut Dantine. Didn't have Bergman. Instead, it had Michelle Morgan, who actually was one of the early choices for the role of Ilse Lund, but she wanted too much money. And the movie just lies there. There is a eulogy that's spoken over someone's grave in that movie that is almost unwatchable.
There were other ways that the war placed restrictions on the making of Casablanca. For instance, in that last scene where Ingrid Bergman and Paul Henreid are escaping on the airplane, they couldn't use a real airplane.
The war had psychological effects on Hollywood, but it also, of course, had a lot of physical effects. And that last scene was shot on the set because you just couldn't go off to airports and shoot planes flying around. There was one scene in Casablanca which was shot at a local airport, but it was the scene with a plane on the ground when Major Strasser is arriving in Casablanca. So they shot this scene at Warner Brothers. They filled the stage with fog, not to make it atmospheric, but to hide the fact that these plywood planes in the background were so phony. And the assistant director got the brilliant idea of making the mechanics on the planes midgets, and thus you would have the perspective that these planes were full height.
So they couldn't use a real plane because all the real planes were being used for the war. Why couldn't they use a real plane?
Well, I would assume there were two things. One, you weren't allowed to do location shooting during the first weeks and months of the war. The hills where Hollywood westerns were shot had anti-aircraft batteries on them, and the army was in charge and was not looking favorably on location shooting. And second, airplanes were just a difficult thing to get clearance for at a time when, remember, Japanese submarines had lain off the coast of California, and there were great fears of air raids.
You watched this movie about 25 times while you were writing your book on the making of Casablanca.
I surely did.
What looks different to you about Casablanca now than it used to?
The most surprising thing that I discovered, and the thing that changed my appreciation of the movie or my reaction to it, was that many, if not most, of the refugees inside Rick's Cafe and running away from the police in the first scenes of the movie were real refugees who had fled from the Nazis. And in doing so, they had had to lose their language. They were, in many cases, important players, people whose names we don't know, like Lottie Palfi and Wolfgang Zilser and Trudi Berliner, were all quite well known in Austria and in Germany. And they came here and they played roles that were defined by occupation. They played the news vendor. They played German officer. And it gives a sadness to me as I watch the movie. And it also, I think, is responsible for a verisimilitude that could not have come if you had just hired people out of central casting.
Elgin Harmitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Terry.
Elgin Harmetz is the author of Roundup the Usual Suspects, The Making of Casablanca.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the arrival of American troops in Baidoa?
Well, Terry, as you know, most of the press beat them there, including our own Deborah Amos and Deborah Wong, and so we'll have reports from both of them on the arrival. Deborah Amos is concentrating on the effort health workers are making to immunize children in Baidoa. We'll also have a discussion on who is responsible for Africa, the United States in the West or the African states themselves, a fairly spirited debate. Sylvia Poggioli will report on the meeting in Geneva about the former Yugoslavia, and we'll have a discussion about war crimes there.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During a Los Angeles heat wave in 1945, Mel Torme and his partner Bob Wells wrote the Christmas song, which Nat King Cole recorded the following year. It's been a Yuletide staple ever since. Torme says the song has been recorded 500 times. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's surely been recorded many more times than that.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
That's Mel Torme, and that's all you need to hear of the Christmas song to fill in the rest in your head. It's stamped on the American brain as firmly as the Star Spangled Banner, and chances are good you'll hear it another 20 or 30 times between now and December 26th, on TV and radio, in stores, doctors' offices, and elevators. The royalties have probably made Torme's Christmases bright for 46 years. But oddly enough, he never put out his own Christmas album till this season. It's called Christmas Songs, recorded with his trio and some musicians from the Cincinnati Pops. He sings a lot of the usual standards, but it's most entertaining for Torme's rather feeble attempts to write another holiday hit.
Christmas was made for children, children like you and me. If you cross your heart and you own up that you've never quite grown up, and you still get a thrill when you trim a Christmas tree. If it's snowing and your cheeks are glowing and you're overflowing with joy, then I have no doubt that as sure as carols are sung, your heart will always stay young. Big or small, that's what it's all about. So clean.
Where's my insulin shot? The thing that makes the Christmas song so effective is it comes at you sideways, creating an atmosphere by accumulating detail. Unlike Christmas Was Made for Children, which shakes you by the neck like a bell Santa rings on a street corner. It's grotesque, but it pales next to Mel's seasonal version of Glowworm. The story goes Johnny Mercer whipped off some special lyrics to his song at a Christmas party, most likely after a couple of trips to the eggnog table. Torme has added even sillier words of his own. I especially like the way you can spot some of the rhymes coming from a mile off.
Glow, little glowworm, intermingle, fly right alongside old Kris Kringle. Pay no attention if you're shooed off. You know that you're a pint-sized Rudolph. Pull out the stops and flash your beacon. All of the kids down here are peeking, hoping to catch your lantern show. Glow,
little glowworm glow. Glow, little glowworm.
It takes a special talent to rhyme shooed off with Rudolph. Now, you're probably thinking I'm one of those people who doesn't like Christmas, let alone Christmas music. And, of course, you're right. Though I've always marveled at how people will buy Christmas records by just anyone. I mean, does anybody remember how big the Waltons' Christmas album was for a few years? But one record I do have a weakness for is the Christmas Collection on the Prestige label, an anthology of seasonal faves played by jazz musicians from Dexter Gordon to Paul Bley. It was first released 4 years ago. That album boasts three versions of the Christmas song, and they show how indestructible its sentiment is, no matter how the players toy with it. This is Gene Ammons, recorded in 1970. Tell me you didn't hear the lyrics in your head listening to that. To write one song that culturally pervasive is a major accomplishment. So unless the bills are piling up, Mel Torme, the songwriter, maybe shouldn't strain to make lightning strike the Christmas tree twice. Unless you're Irving Berlin, one classic per holiday ought to be enough.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic living in New York City. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Dreams, hey, bring on those Christmas presents. Opening presents is such fun. Christmas was made for children. God bless us, bless us, everyone. God bless us, everyone. God bless us, everyone. God bless us, everyone.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
To many people, Alger Hiss is the Benedict Arnold of his generation, convicted of spying for the Soviets. A recent search of Soviet archives turned up no evidence that Hiss was ever a Soviet agent. Hiss says this clears his name. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Alger Hiss and his son Tony Hiss. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Annual holiday event from National Public Radio. Monday night at 9 o'clock on WHYY.